Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Itasha K. Womack, author of Black Panther, A Cultural Exploration. Itasha is a critically acclaimed author, filmmaker, dancer, independent scholar, and champion of humanity and the imagination. Her book, Afrofuturism, The World of Black Sci-Fi and Fantasy Culture, is the leading primer on the exciting subject which bridges science fiction, futurisms, and culture. And Itasha, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. I'm quite excited to be here.
And I'm quite excited to talk about the Black Panther comics with you. And I'm going to start off by asking you, what impact did the Black Panther comics have on you?
You know, it's interesting. I think like a lot of people, as a kid, I wasn't familiar with the character. I came up in the 80s and 90s. And of course, I knew the Black Panther Party, wasn't familiar with the comic. And there's actually kind of a historical marker around that. One of the things I've learned in the research and in talking to people about, you know, just comics in general, as I started to write about them, was that, you know, comics in the 80s and 90s moved from being accessible in, say, comic book stores, or excuse me, being accessible in drugstores and pharmacies and newsstands, and really started to become just more accessible in comic book stores themselves. And you didn't have comic book stores in all neighborhoods. So I think for some people, you know, access to comics in those years really sort of shifted. And then, you know, the Black Panther character, as exciting and dynamic as it was, there were gaps when in the series and its release in the 80s and 90s. So my first real discussions about the Black Panther character actually kind of emerged in the, you know, the early 2000s. When I started hanging out in comic book circles and being a part of these comic book conventions that were put together by Black creators to celebrate independent comics. And they were talking about how much they loved the Black Panther comic and how they wanted to see more done with the Black Panther superhero. And I was like, wait, the Black Panther superhero? And in retrospect, I remembered hearing about that character, but hadn't had the opportunity to see issues. So I was hanging out with people who, as Blade had become more popular, was talking about Black Panther in the comic book. And then there was a documentary that I saw that was about, you know, Black superheroes in comics. And, you know, by the time I wrote the book Afrofuturism, there was really this kind of groundswelling interest and amongst creators in seeing more evolutions with the Black Panther character in comics and beyond.
So you mentioned not seeing it a while and seeing the actual comic book when you first were working in this field and where you were growing up, at least. And I think one of the interesting things about the history you wrote of the Black Panther comics is when I thought of it, I thought, okay, he had his own comic book. But then reading your history, he actually started off as a character in another comic book, right?
Right. Yeah. He debuted in 1966 in a Fantastic Four comic. So one of the things I write about in the book, I talk about Floyd Webb and his experience as a kid in Chicago, a teenager, saying how he was reading the book and how excited he and his friends were to see a Black character. One, in a book, period, but two, is specifically in the Fantastic Four comic, because the Fantastic Four were, you know, this unconventional family that was, you know, at the time they were beating everybody. And there was a lot of excitement about Marvel characters because they had issues and dynamics that a lot of teenagers at the time could connect with. So here you have the Black Panther character debuting in the Fantastic Four, and then later appearing in as the title character in a book called Jungle Action. And Jungle Action, you know, written by Don McGregor, was really the arc of Black Panther coming into his own. We're introduced to more about the world of Wakanda. Killmonger comes out through this series. And so much of the foundation of the character is really written in the Jungle Action series.
Now, I'm going to ask you real quick. So was the Jungle Action series a Black Panther comic, or once again, he was a major character in a series?
Jungle Action actually was a title for kind of a lot of these series that had the Tarzan feel to it. But when Don McGregor was, you know, looking at the series, he said, you know what, this is not of the times. we need to write something else. And, you know, this, you had the backdrop of the civil rights movement and, you know, the Black arts movement. And so Don McGregor says, okay, let's take this and, you know, write a story around Black Panther. And so later that series was sort of pointed to as his first book, but it wasn't, he was the lead character. It was all about him and Wakanda, but the title of the book was not Black Panther. It wasn't until late 70s, early 80s that you have Black Panther in his first book. And that one, of course, is a story told by Jack Kirby, one of our Marvel founders. And that tale just has Black Panther, you know, on this romp around the world.
A lot of us didn't really get introduced to the character Black Panther, or at least remembered him, until the movie. And so it was the movie that sort of created this groundswell of recognition of the Black Panther. And a lot of people, I believe, went from seeing Black Panther in the movie to then going back and saying, let me go look at the Black Panther comics. So what impact did the movie have on the work that you do in Afrofuturism?
Well, as an Afrofuturist, when I wrote the book Afrofuturism, the World of Black Sci-Fi and Fantasy Culture, the popularization of the term helped a lot of people to sort of anchor their ideas around Black culture, science fiction, and they're able to sort of group these comics, independent comics, comics like a Black Panther, thinking about the funk music era of Parliament and Funkadelic, or characters like Janelle Monáe, or technology and Black music, or African philosophy, mysticism. That word helped to sort of bring all of those ideas together and thinking about Black futures and creativity around Black futures. And so, but when I was, you know, writing the term Afrofuturism, it wasn't, you know, you're sort of helping people to connect to things they had a relationship with, they'd sort of seen before, but it was almost like shaping the abyss, right? And when the film came out, it was, one, very Afrofuturist, and two, became probably the first collective global image of a fantastic Black futuristic world that in the Marvel Universe was very present. So, and the success of it, the arc of the characters, the adventures of Black Panther, I think, one, verified for a lot of people that there's a real interest in these sort of stories, but also it made people want to look at more. And they wanted to learn more about the Black Panther comic. But I think for people creating Afrofuturist works, they created more of a demand for their work to look at both the creative works, the literature, the music, the comics, but also to talk more about Afrofuturism as theory and world building and looking at how those practices and strategies could help us create protopian worlds with utopian leanings.
Well, I'm going to segue into the exhibit happening at the National Museum for African American History and Culture on Afrofuturism, which to me, looking at that exhibit, or at least looking at the book about the exhibit, and I'm looking forward to actually visiting the exhibit, what was so astounding was all the physical representations that were available to put up for display. And of course, you contributed to the coffee table book on Afrofuturism on the exhibit, which once again, it's a beautiful book with incredible prose in it. And I was never thought, for example, of Parliament and George Clinton. I grew up on Parliament and George Clinton and Bootsy's Rubber Band, but it never clicked in my mind to connect it with Afrofuturism, even though you saw it as, okay, this space futuristic look at things, but it just never clicked in my mind. So when you saw that Afrofuturistic, when you learned they were doing an exhibit and they asked you to write about some parts of Afrofuturism for the book, what was your reaction to it? Because I'm just blown away by it.
Well, to go from writing a book on Afrofuturism and 95% of the people engaging with it were learning the term for the first time, to say almost a decade later, going to a point where the Smithsonian, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, is using Afrofuturism as a way to talk about space and imagination and liberatory futures is a real testament to the recognition of how these ideas have played such a role in our cultures over the years and always. You know, people of African descent on the continent have always had a relationship to their future. They've always had a relationship to time and space. But I think it's really fun to look at how that's expressed in art and music and the culture and bringing it all together where it's centralized. So to walk into an exhibit like the one at the Smithsonian, and it's called Afrofuturism, A History of the Future, and you're looking at a book that W.B. Du Bois wrote that contains a short story called The Comet, which is his science fiction story, or to look at a typewriter by an Octavia Butler, or to look at just the amalgamation of fantastic costuming and instruments. You know, you're looking at Sun Ra's costumes and a letter that he wrote to NASA. You know, this jazz musician wrote a letter to NASA asking if he could essentially have an internship so that he could record sounds in space and put it in his music. Or you're looking at a space harp, you know, that was created by Phil Coran, one of the founders of the AACM, this avant-garde jazz collective. And, you know, you're looking at, you know, these space costumes, I won't say space costumes, actually astronaut uniforms. And then there's one touching moment where you're looking at astronaut costumes that are next to Trayvon Martin's space uniform that he used to wear when he was a part of a space camp. And so you're thinking about how space has inspired people to literally get careers in aviation and become astronauts, or how it's inspired them creatively, or how you have these childhood dreams and wishes that in some ways get curtailed, but there's a desire to want to recognize who you are in the broader universe, and to see how that was expressed in Black creativity and aspiration all in one space is just phenomenal.
I want to go back to the history of the Black Panther comic, because we talked about its beginning in 1966, and I was specifically looking at the history from 1966 to 1976, where it was intermittent, that you would see the Black Panther character intermittently, but just not consistently. What was going on there?
Well, you had the character debut in the Fantastic Four comic. And then you had the series, the Jungle Action series, which Don McGregor wrote, which was a really hard-hitting, heavy series, right? We're talking early 70s. So Don McGregor, who, was a white man, a writer, very much an ally to the culture, was writing really sort of these empowered stories where you're taking this character of Black Panther and he's having him fight the Klan. You know, there's a... Black Panther fights the Klan. Black Panther, you know, tussling with Killmonger, you know, this, and you know, a lot of people know the Killmonger character from the film. In the film, he's Black Panther's first cousin, but in the comic, he is a person who just really has an issue with Black Panther as a monarch and a leader, and is challenging him, you know, feeling like he's always off and about. And so I just think about kind of those early years, you know, and you're introduced to these characters within the Wakanda world. And I just think about how exciting it was for people to sort of read that comic at the time and the meaning that it had. And, you know, but what's sort of interesting about comics, and you probably know this very well, Hopeton, is that people, you know, there's a period when people just wear comics as teens and then you grow out of it. There wasn't this idea that you could keep reading them as adults. Today you have graphic novel collections, so you could buy collections if you missed issues. You could go back and buy a series, you know, a series of 10 and a book. You couldn't really do that in the 70s, 80s, 90s. If you missed a comic, you missed it, you know, and that's why you had all these collectors and people trying to trade comics and get access to them. Comics were written on disposable paper. You know, it was written on inexpensive paper. They weren't always, you had people collecting them, but they weren't always designed as keepsakes. And so I think about this really sort of dynamic character of Black Panther coming out and the meaning that it had for people who would treasure it, but then grew out of it. And then, you know, maybe a decade or so later, when the character was reintroduced again, it's another group of people engaging with the character, right? And then they grow out of it. And then some years go by and another group of people re-engage with the character. And so it wasn't until 1998 that you had the comics. Christopher Priest. And then the comics coming out consistently. Don McGregor did another series in the late 80s where Black Panther is fighting apartheid. He's looking for his stepmother, who they thought had left the family to be, you know, with another guy. And then they find out that she actually been kidnapped in a world that was comparable to South Africa in the apartheid era. So Black Panther had to go to this equivalent of South Africa. And then he's engaging with apartheid. And battling characters in the midst of that and finding his mom. And so it's an interesting evolution of looking at a character who at various points is dealing with real social issues, right? And then sort of, you know, by the time you get to 98, some of the writers who are coming in, Christopher Priest wrote, you know, the issues from 98 to almost 2005. And then you have, you know, these sort of other evolutions in the character. You're really starting to see an expansion of the world, of how people are talking about Wakanda. And, you know, Reginald Hutlin, who wrote the Black Panther character after Christopher Priest, he's the one who really introduces Shuri and elevates, you know, the fighting women of Wakanda, the Dora, and he elevates them to be this sort of sophisticated fighting force that doesn't, you know, resemble just like, you know, hot chicks with this guy.
So let me jump in here, because I'm interested in what you saw was the difference between, because Christopher Priest actually worked for Marvel. Mm-hmm. And how he wrote Black Panther from 1998 to 2003, whereas Reginald Hudlin came from the outside, was a well-known movie director. We all know, you know,
right.
Kid in Play and all that was related to that. He was also the president of Black Entertainment Television. In your opinion, what different approaches did you see them bring to the comic in terms of plot line seams and the centering of the African diaspora experience?
Well, Christopher Priest was writing the character in a period. I mean, the Black Panther was sort of being positioned along with Daredevil, is comics that were going to be for slightly older fans, meaning maybe older teenagers, you know, people in their early adult years. And so it had, you know, I think about like the Dark Knight series as a backdrop, but you have sort of this grittier, grimier story that's taking place. And Christopher Priest, you know, in telling this story, he's taking a character who, again, he has the charge of having to reintroduce this character to a fan base whose previous fan bases, you know, are not as attached to comics, right? So, and he also didn't want to be limited to, you know, people thinking, oh, he's a Black writer, he has to write Black characters and he can't write anything else. So he took this really interesting approach where he's telling Black Panther's story from the perspective of a white federal agent. And that becomes the entire arc where he's, you know, you have this white federal agent who is supposed to be in conversation with Black Panther, either sometimes supporting or documenting or spying or just, you know, staying on being aware of what's happening in the world of Wakanda. And there's this kind of tongue-in-cheek commentary around it because he's a, you know, kind of a regular guy who is now all of a sudden having to chase, run around with Black Panther. And there's an aspect of the story that has this surreal commentary to it, where sometimes you're not sure whether he's telling things that he actually saw or he's telling things that he thinks happened, you know, because it's not like Black Panther is just explaining everything he's doing to him, right? And so there's kind of a tongue-in-cheek interest in that. And so Black Panther comes across as very slick, very smooth, very not just super smart, but also a guy with a kind of, you know, finesse, and I'll just say swag, that is admirable in one sense to the federal agent who's following him. But then simultaneously, he's getting, you know, drawn into these worlds in Harlem and also Wakanda, because Black Panther had a base and a housing project in Harlem in this particular iteration of the comic, and was going between Harlem and Wakanda. So, you know, there's that. There's the character sort of being dragged into these worlds that become a bit mystical, where he's, you know, engaging with Dr. Voodoo, or he's engaging with, you know, these sort of Egyptian stories come to life, right? In the midst of the Black Panther tale. So Christopher Priest really told this sort of action-packed, fast-moving, I almost say surrealist story about Black Panther. And then you move into Reginald Hutland, who, again, he literally, you know, is again, charged with sort of introducing this character to an audience. And so what Reginald Hutland does is he starts adding these different elements to the story that round out the world and Black Panther's family life. So prior to Reginald Hutland, we know that Black Panther had a stepmom. We know that he has, you know, a father who is killed. And we know that he also had a white half-brother who he's raised with, who was found, you know, after a plane crashed in Wakanda. And so when we get into this era where Reginald Hutland is working, he introduces Shuri, the sister. You know, he introduces a stronger love thing for Black Panther, and by pairing Black Panther with Storm. You know, Storm.
That was a shock, you know, to me. That was a revelation to me. Black Panther and Storm had no idea.
Yeah. So they had not just a romance, but were actually married. And the thought was, again, he's rounding out the family life. And then Reginald Hutland also adds these other elements for backstories with Wakanda, you know, where you have Captain America, you know, going into Wakanda around World War II, and then introduces an African-American soldier, you know, who's decides to live in Wakanda, you know, shortly after World War II. So, and so we're sort of dealing with, you know, the building of a kind of legacy. I think there are even offshoots. There was an offshoot where Black Panther and Storm, you know, have children. And, you know, and this sort of futuristic telling of a of their relationship. But once again, you had battles and wars and you know, Storm and Black Panther had a marriage that was annulled. And so then you bring in, you know, you have the next iteration with Ta-Nehisi Coates, who writes. And this is sort of interesting, right? So you're going from Christopher Priest, who becomes this really well-known comics writer, to Reginald Hutland, who's this, you know, famous movie director, to Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's this revered, you know, essayist and writer talking about, you know, the critical issues of our time. All of these individuals are writing the Black Panther story.
And, you know, yeah, this is interesting because I read comics when I was really young, 6, 5, 6, 7, 8, and I was reading the Marvel comics. But what I think is interesting is you're a writer, you write books, and this world where, and now I'm asking you for your opinion, this world where a character is steward, the steward of the character changes regularly over time. You got one writer, you got another writer. I don't know how many writers were writing the comic books about the Black Panther, where the Black Panther appeared. But how do you think of that as a creative person when a character is has several different stewards as opposed to one writer who writes 10 books about the same character?
Well, I think about it in the way that I think about mythologies. You know, Black Panther and Wakanda are very much, you know, a part of our modern mythologies. You can even argue that superheroes in general probably fall into that category of these kind of contemporary myths that we look to get some understanding of our lives. And you have people constantly shaping the narrative. When I put together this book, Black Panther, A Cultural Exploration, I was thinking from the perspective of, okay, the character evolved out of these cultural touch points. And then the character in turn impacts us and shapes the culture and or sort of codifies some of these relationships to liberation or being a hero or what's right and wrong. So for me, I think it's sort of fascinating. One, it's a joy and an honor to be able to, as a writer, dig into a world that's already established with this character and think about how they can navigate in this world, how you could tell a story, how to make it more robust. You know, in a lot of ways, it's like the ultimate challenge. It's the ultimate honor. And then it can completely wig you out at the same time. But all comics, you know, Black Panther aside, have been written by multiple writers with multiple illustrators and multiple colorists, you know, all adding their lens or their take on how these characters should evolve or how they relate to our lives as times change.
Well, interesting enough, I always have to keep in mind that Black Panther debuted in 1966 and we're 57 years later. It'd be kind of hard to have the same person writing the character. But also, I think, like you said, when the character reflects the cultural time, the culture of the times, what's going on at the times, which if you had the same writer writing it for 50 years, they may not be as forward thinking as bringing in fresh minds to write the character as opposed to the same writer for 50 years?
Well, and I think other questions come into play, right? So when Ta-Nehisi Coates starts writing the Black Panther, his big question becomes, well, if Wakanda is this protopia, it's this ultimate Black world, it hasn't been colonized, it has this deep meaning for people, would an uncolonized Black world with amazing technologies have a monarchy? Which is like, okay. And so his arc of the story is all about this increasing demand for a democracy in Wakanda with the representation of government. And also, you know, Black Panther giving another level of thought to what it means to, you know, be in an empire, you know. So there's this whole space saga that happens, you know, in one of Ta-Nehisi Coates' runs, which is, I think, one of the best Black Panther runs, called Intergalactic Wakanda, where Black Panther finds himself in space, enslaved in what's essentially a Wakanda universe that stretches across other planets. And it's loosely based off of the actual Wakanda on Earth, because it's a future version where various astronauts have went into space and they formed their own society. And then what? Then Black Panther somehow winds up there. And so he's kind of working his way up from the bottom. And there's all of this expectation. People know that there's a T'Challa who will come and sort of end the sense of tyranny, right? So we're seeing some kind of biblical metaphors here. But it gets into this really deeper story of looking at responsibility, empires. You know, Black Panther himself realizes that, you know, he's thinking about responsibility and leadership, and even questioning Bast, who was like the Panther goddess, you know. So there's this interrogation of his own belief system, where Bast in this world, you know, becomes, her powers are sort of zapped by this Killmonger emperor. And she becomes this like petulant child who's almost very Elegba-like, who's constantly prodding Black Panther, trying to make him be better in the ways that he is not happy with, right? So it's this complete like fantastic space saga with all these spiritual like metaphors and insights into just evolutions of society. You see parallels with narratives in the diaspora around moving from enslavement to another kind of sense of empowerment. It was pretty dynamic, but it was one of the most fantastic stories. And so, but that's something he would bring, right?
So
because these are the questions he's looking to answer in the world of Wakanda.
So if someone's only watched the movies, the two movies, What should they be prepared for? And do you have recommendations, once again, your opinion on going from the movies to say, okay, I watched the movies, I love the movies, now I want to dig deep into the Black Panther comics. Where should they start? What should they expect? Your opinion.
Well, I would say start with my books. Black Panther.
Of course, read your book. But...
right. But that aside, one of the interesting things about mythologies, right, is that even as they move to different iterations, you can always jump in wherever you are now and get a feel for what happened previously. So I think about, when soap operas were more popular. You know, you can miss a soap opera for a decade, jump in, and it's sort of the same characters in a similar kind of tango dance, right? And I think about Black Panther in a similar sort of way. You can always start with the present series. You know, Eve Ewing, she's writing the present series. You can just go to the beginning of that series and see where things are from there. Another approach is to take a look and see, well, what were some of the previous series? And if you say, hey, I want to go back, you know, you could go back to some of the first series and you could start reading there if you want. Or you could look at certain themes of different series, you know, in the book, you know, that I wrote breaks those down. And you could start with what seems to be like your favorite theme and move from there. The cool thing is a lot of these series are now in graphic novel form. So you can get a series of, say, a Christopher Priest run and four or five graphic novels that'll have like all of the comics in them and just sort of read it over time. So you can buy them as collections.
What impact did it have on you doing the work for this book, the research? Did it affect your view of Afrofuturism? Did you get thoughts and ideas that you've decided to incorporate in the future work that you do? Is there any impact you can cite that researching and writing this book has had on your thoughts and ideas on Afrofuturism?
Right. Well, I think one of the things that stood out to me was probably exactly what you mentioned, right? Which was this idea of this robust mythology where you have a seminal figure, Black Panther, you know, the young prince who becomes a king, who is wrestling with this idea of wanting to be a bit wanderlust and go around the world, but also, you know, you have a kingdom to run. You're a superhero. The Avengers need you to save all kinds of planets that are about to implode and restore the world. But you have a nation and a group of people who you are king of, in addition to being Black Panther, which are two different roles, but often utilized by one. He has ancestors who he's accountable to. He has a council he's accountable to. He has a population he's accountable to. And yet these expectations of what he's supposed to do. And then, of course, by that time Ta-Nehisi Coates run, he's also becomes head of an empire. So he's head of a galactic empire. He's head of the country of Wakanda. And then at various points, he's head of the Avengers. And so I think of him as this character who's kind of always juggling these things. And I think what really struck me was what struck you was what different writers bring to that. Or when they start thinking about Black cultures or African cultures, African diasporic cultures, what elements within those cultures they want to highlight, what social issues they find interesting. It was interesting to see like a lot of the spiritual references or the philosophical references, for example. So I felt like, as a person who had read maybe some of the comics, when I read all of them, I was really amazed by how much information and history and lore from real world spaces were integrated into the piece. And it made me have a different appreciation for these four modern mythologies. Floyd Webb, who I interviewed, who's a film curator, said that Black Panther is our liberation avatar. And he wasn't just talking about, you know, Black Panther, the character or the party or other iterations, but just what Panthers have meant in various cultures and societies over time, which we also talk about in the book. So I guess I was just, I really had to sort of think about what other mythologies in a contemporary context existed so robustly that many writers and many people, you know, were able to shape or are aware of. And outside of like real world events that happened that became, you know, mythologized over time, you know, it's a bit of a stretch to sort of think of some that are contemporary. But Black Panther, you know, in the world of Wakanda stands out. I think something else that became really, really obvious to me and had a bit of impact, which I think is very Afrofuturist, is that Black Panther is intimately tied to the world of Wakanda. And Wakanda is intimately tied to his existence. So as a writer, usually your main characters are outgrowths of their world, right? And there's this tangible relationship. But it was interesting to see the relationship between Black Panther or Shuri when she becomes Black Panther, and because Shuri becomes Black Panther in the comic at various iterations when T'Challa is gone, right? And so it's just to see the relationship that they have to the world, how they are informed as much by the world as the world informs them, I thought was kind of this, it was an interesting way to think about like characters and story and even Afrofuturism.
So I mean, Tasha, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, what is Wakanda without Black Panther?
Well,
now you could say, what is Wakanda without T'Challa? right? But just the Black Panther idea is like bigger than the all of any individual who's taken on that role throughout the course of Wakanda.
So let's segue into Wakanda, because it's not a fantasy, as you've sort of referenced or alluded to. It's not a fantasy solely cut from imagination, but I believe is based in part on advanced empires in Africa from the past that have not been given their proper due. In your opinion, how were the history and cultural practices of those empires incorporated into the comic book series?
Well, they were, you know, it's so interesting that you can look at it on the surface and you say, okay, Black, you know, Wakanda, uncolonized, you know, world, African nation. And you're like, oh, okay, well, Ethiopia wasn't colonized. Right. And I think about, you know, Ethiopia and the inspiration that the nation had for so many people. You know, I think about kind of the Rastafarian philosophy evolving out of this idea, you know, of how Selassie, you know, being almost a deity, right? Or this kind of reincarnated figure and that as a sort of mythos, very real mythos, right? 20th century mythos as well, that evolved from an actual empire, you know, that was able to push out Italy when they were trying to take over. So that's a reference point. There's also something that I thought was pretty interesting and didn't really know till I researched this. Some of the parallels with, you know, some of the African liberation movements. And, you know, people who've read a bit about the Black Panther might know that at one point the Black Panther was going to be called the Cold Tiger. And you're just like, okay, are they just trying to take something Black and feline? Like, where's this term coming from? But that was also a term used in the press that was referring to the liberation movements of African nations in the 50s and 60s. And so there's some sort of interesting parallels that some people saw with actual figures who were leading some of those liberation movements, you know, thinking about Patrice Lumumba, for example. And it was so fascinating to me. Again, you know, Floyd Webb, you know, the curator who I interviewed for this book, he said as a kid, when he was reading that, he was like, oh, this is Patrice Lumumba. Oh, they're talking about, you know, the nations of the Congo. Oh, vibranium. They're talking about all the resources, you know, that are there, all the minerals, you know. I mean, a lot of the elements we use in our cell phone are from the Congo nations, right? So I think about that is like, oh, wow, that's very interesting. And when I look at the temperament that T'Challa has, it mimics that of Patrice Lumumba, almost, you know, in some ways, and look a little more than some other figures who we sometimes think about. I know that, wow, there's other references too. I mean, Bast, the panther goddess, is pulled from Egyptian mythology or Egyptian spiritual pantheons of the past. So Bast or Bastet, you know, she's often depicted as sort of this Black cat, but she's not like this domesticated cat. And in the book, we show that in King Tut's tomb, we find images of Black Panthers or King Tut riding a Black Panther, standing upon a Black Panther. And so there's this idea that panthers, Rita Lucarelli was telling me there's this idea that Black Panthers or panthers in general weren't a part of Egyptian culture or Nubian culture, right? And it's like, no, actually, they really were. You're finding them in images of them in the tombs of major pharaohs. So there's that, and that symbolism of what Bast was. She was this, you know, protective figure. And in the storyline as well, the Ta-Nehisi Coates writes, in addition to Bast, there's this creation of this pantheon of who are entities, like sort of these spiritual guides of Wakanda that are called Loa and Orishas, but they don't necessarily pull from the Orisha and Loa pantheon. But they're made up of Thoth, an Egyptian god of sort of wisdom and knowledge. And then even Storm, who's sort of based off of these like rain goddesses, you know, and in Eastern Africa, she becomes an Orisha or a deity. And the Orishas, that's like a spiritual term out of the Ifa religion, originally out of Nigeria, amongst the Yoruba, and then had a big influence in you know, parts of Latin America, or well, in America as well, where these sort of spiritual deities, anyway, the spiritual deities within Wakanda are called Orisha, and that's coming from this Ifa paradigm of belief. So, or Loa, you know, which come from the Budan pantheon of beliefs. And so I just said, wow, there's a lot of really interesting things going on here. Where Wakanda and what inspires it is coming from some interesting real world spaces that are remixed a bit.
Well, Itasha Womack, I really enjoyed your book on Black Panther, A Cultural Exploration. I look forward to your next two books. You want to tell us a little bit about your next two books that'll be coming out in 2024 and 2025 or for...
Well, I have a book coming out on Black Cube. It's called Black Cube. It's coming out on Megascope Abrams. It's a graphic novel. So I guess this deep dive in Black Panther was a nice foray into sort of thinking about this other work that I had written. It's and it's about Egyptian deities who are curating lives and becomes a sort of metaphor for creativity in the African diaspora in the continent. And it's illustrated by Tana Tucker. So I'm super excited about that. And then I'll have a follow-up to Afrofuturism that will be out as well, which I'm crafting and honing because so much has happened, you know, in recent years. And it's fun to do deep dives and thinking about Afrofuturism as practice.
And you originally published Afrofuturism, The World of Black Sci-Fi and Fantasy Culture in 2013. More information on the work of Itasha Womack is available on her website, itashawomack.com. Thank you so much. This is a wonderful book. Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm glad you're excited about the project.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.